Blog Talk Radio.
Hello again, and thank you for joining the Socialist Insight. My name is Stuart Alexander, and we would like to welcome you to our program again today. Today we have Darcy Richardson. Darcy Richardson is a longtime friend, and also I might mention he is a historian, he's a writer, journalist, and also a political consultant. Darcy, please take a minute just to tell our listeners who you are and just a little bit about yourself, please.
Okay, thank you, Stuart, and thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Darcy Richardson. I have lived in Jacksonville, Florida for the past just about 20 years, 19 years, originally from the Philadelphia area, back in Pennsylvania. I've had a long history in independent and third-party politics. Going back to when I was 19, I had volunteered in the late Senator Eugene McCarthy's independent campaign for the White House in the year of the American Bicentennial, 76, and kind of got my feet wet at that point, and really for the past 36 years have dabbled sometimes much more extensively than others in third-party politics. I've also written at this point a five-volume history of independent and third-party politics in the U.S. dating back to the country's founding, and we definitely were not founded as a two-party establishment or system. That's not what the founders had in mind. But over the years, I've also run for office a number of times, in addition to local office back in Cheltenham, Pennsylvania, in a period of my life when I was a Democrat. I've also run as a third-party candidate for State Auditor General of Pennsylvania back in 1980 when I was 23, 24 years old. Also ran on the Philadelphia-based Consumer Party ticket for the U.S. Senate in 1988, a year when I doubled as Gene McCarthy's campaign manager. McCarthy was waging one of his five campaigns for president that year. And here in Florida, I've been involved in a number of campaigns, including Walt Brown's campaign for the presidency in 2004. Walt was a Socialist Party candidate. I hosted Walt and his wife at the time in my home for the final week of that campaign. And more recently, I ran for Lieutenant Governor of Florida with Iranian-born economist Fareed Kavari. We ran on a platform calling for a state-owned bank here in Florida, and, mm-hmm. And then most recently made a forlorn bid for the Democratic nomination for president, challenging President Obama in about a half a dozen states.
Well, Darcy, obviously you've done a lot. You've been all over the political landscape. As I mentioned, you work as a political consultant. You work with the Brian Moore and Stuart Alexander campaign when we were representing the Socialist Party in 2007 and 2008.
Right.
But just getting back to this campaign that you were recently involved in when you were running as a presidential candidate for 2012, why did you choose to run as a presidential candidate in 2012?
Well, it certainly wasn't my intention to do so. I had hoped that somebody would challenge President Obama from the left, initially within the Democratic Party structure, and I had reached out to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich and Dennis Kucinich and a few others, urging them to consider, you know, mounting a campaign during 2011. I never did get a response from Mr. Reich, but I did hear from Dennis Kucinich's staff, and they and I've known Dennis for a number of years, but they said that the congressman was going to focus on his, you know, reelection bid in a district that had been redistricted, so he had to run against Marcy Kaptur in the primary, and that was understandable. Of course, Marcy Kaptur ended up winning that race. And, probably, in hindsight, it might have been okay for Kucinich to go ahead and challenge Obama.
Actually run. Well, let me ask you, obviously you did enter the race. Some states you were on the ballot, some, here in California, other states you were not. But obviously you were looking for someone that could actually challenge Barack Obama. What were some of the challenges that you actually that you were faced with as a candidate running on the seeking the Democratic nomination?
Well, the biggest obstacle was, you know, being very little known. I did get some early coverage in the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, some of the major press, kind of a brief mention of my candidacy when I first entered the New Hampshire primary. But basically, it was kind of running under the radar the entire time. I wasn't invited to any Democratic functions whatsoever, not even like county, you know, county Democratic dinners or things like that. I mean, it was totally, you know, Obama's running unopposed was the official line. So it was basically just a grassroots effort. You know, we had our website up, and we did hear from about 400 to 500 people who volunteered for the campaign. So it was basically a word of mouth campaign. We didn't have really anything in the way of an advertising budget. In fact, I don't even think we spent $25,000 on the entire effort. But basically, mobilizing anti-war activists, people, you know, really concerned about the economy, and just getting whatever free publicity we could. You know, radio interviews. I would definitely speak to, you know, any reporters that were just out of curiosity interested in what we were doing. And we did, you know, we did fairly well in some places. In Oklahoma, we I think got about 6% of the vote. In Louisiana, they had a Saturday primary on March 24th. Believe it or not, I did carry 96 precincts against Obama, which doesn't seem like much, but and we ran really well in Wynn Parish, which was considered the, you know, the most impoverished parish in Louisiana, and a place that Gene Debs had carried in 1912. So I was kind of proud about that we finished a pretty decent second. And but basically it was, you know, if I had to do it over again, I probably wouldn't do it. But it was just more out of frustration that nobody was challenging Obama, you know, from a progressive perspective. And there were a number of issues I wanted to talk about.
Let me, Darcy, also as a candidate with the Democratic Party, what difference were you actually hoping to offer working people throughout the nation, offer voters and working people?
Right. I focused my entire campaign on the economy. And I first had a serious issue with President Obama, really as soon as he took office, when he appointed Larry Summers as his chairman of the White House Economic Council. Summers, people might remember, had been, he's probably the person most responsible for the country's current economic mess. And I say that based on what William Grider had written back in late 2008 in Rolling Stone magazine, where he pointed out that, that, you know, Summers had really been the one that had persuaded President Clinton to sign the financial deregulation bill that really did away with the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. And of course, the Glass-Steagall
And we're
going
to get in. I have a few questions I want to get into on that later, but anyway, please.
But there was that issue. There were other issues involving the economy, but also the wars. You know, Obama took a great deal of pride in, you know, saying that he had ended the war in Iraq, when all he really did was preside over the ending of it. The end had actually been negotiated by the Bush administration, so they just kind of presided over it. And then, of course, Obama escalated U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and has been, you know, waging a number of proxy wars in Libya, and Syria, Yemen, Somalia, you know, elsewhere. So I had a lot of issues with the president that I thought should be addressed. Then, of course, his signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, allowing for indefinite detention without charge or trial. and also worldwide assassination. That became a part of U.S. policy. So I thought, well, isn't anyone on the left, you know, going to challenge a president who really, in my view, was nothing more than a center-right chief executive? You know, he could have been a Republican. He pretty much, you know, carried out a lot of, or continued a lot of the Bush policies, which were absolutely disastrous for the country, and we're still feeling the effects of them. It was just, it was really, my candidacy was really just out of a sense of overall frustration. And
I understand.
Lost a lot of respect for a lot of Democrats that I once admired, or at least, you know, agreed with on a number of issues over the years, when nobody was willing to step forward and hold Obama's feet to the fire.
When you were out there on the campaign trail and you were talking to various voters about many of the policies that President Obama has actually supported, how did people receive that in regards to the National Defense Authorization Act? Because apparently a lot of people, many voters, are not even aware of the ramifications of that. How was that received?
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of people weren't aware of it. Of course, you know, Obama signed that legislation, I think, in the middle of the night on New Year's Eve. So it didn't get a lot of immediate attention. A lot of the, you know, left-wing blogs and anti-war activists were aware of it. And they responded, and they were livid about it. But they did like the fact that I was addressing that as an issue. Some of the peace activists in the various states, including New Hampshire. I got a very limited hearing, so we weren't able to really, you know, use any kind of megaphone to get that message out.
I understand. Darcy, shortly after the primaries, you shifted gears and supported the Reform Party's presidential candidate, Buddy Romer, who withdrew from the presidential contest. Why did you decide to make that shift to support a Reform Party candidate?
Well, it wasn't done very enthusiastically. I had spoken to Governor Romer in April, and I was kind of seeing that my Democratic candidacy wasn't going anywhere. I thought, a lot of what Romer was talking about in this post-Citizens United world about the corrupting influence of money in politics and just how much the financial sector was investing in, you know, President Obama and Mitt Romney, I thought he'd be a good voice to have, you know, in the general election. And I was kind of trying to persuade him to seek the Reform Party nomination, which he did at one point announce that he was going to seek. But as soon as he failed to get the Americans Elect nomination, as soon as they disbanded their organization nationally, Romer dropped out. But he seemed to have a really good grasp on economic issues. He's a banker who's never foreclosed on anyone. He has kind of a populist streak, and I think he has some appeal to the Occupy movement. And I just thought that his would be a good voice to have, in the November campaign. But of course, he pulled out.
Well, Darcy, I want to ask also, let's consider whatever to the best of his ability may be.
Mm-hmm.
Has President Obama fulfilled his promises that he made to American voters in 2007 and 2008? In your opinion?
No, actually, I think he's been, you know, pretty much a very big disappointment. You know, in addition to failing to resurrect the Glass-Steagall Act, he went back on his promise to include a public option in his health care bill. He's time and again failed to assert his constitutional responsibility. Most recently, during the debt crisis, debt limit crisis, and it was during that period that he also said that, you know, he indicated a willingness to put Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block, you know, to get a deal with the Republican-controlled House. Those were all things that worried me. But throughout his presidency, there were a number of issues. He didn't fight on the issue of the Bush, you know, extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, he just went along with the GOP there, as if, you know, 8 years of freeloading by the rich and famous wasn't enough. And his use of accelerating the war in Afghanistan, but also deploying drones was a very disturbing development. We're deploying drones that are like far more sophisticated than and deadly than anything used by the Nazis. You know, the Nazi V1 and V2, the so-called flying bombs, which had been involved in the terror bombing of London in World War II.
Well, those were more like a shotgun approach, and these drones are like a bullet approach.
Right, exactly. And you know,
not only are they terrifying, but they're just destroying families and communities and people, the lifestyles of entire communities, as I mentioned. But anyway, please.
But those were basically the issues, and it's just his overall mishandling of the U.S. economy. Was probably my primary motivation for running, beginning with his $787 billion stimulus package in early 2009. That wasn't nearly enough, considering. And let's be fair here, considering the depth of the mess that he inherited. I mean, he inherited this mess. It wasn't of his making, as the GOP is now trying to convince people. He inherited one big mess. But I thought, you know, with the $787 billion stimulus package should have been probably four times that size to really pull us out. What we needed was a true American recovery, you know, something similar to, you know, what FDR had done with the New Deal during the Great Depression. And unfortunately, much of the stimulus package, even though the Republicans railed against it, it was used by Republican governors and Republican state legislatures to balance their budgets. They didn't have to make the hard decisions. They used Obama's stimulus money to avoid, cutting jobs and raising taxes in their own states. So the Republicans that railed against it, other than Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida at the time, who embraced it and defended it, the other Republicans, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, Rick Perry in Texas, they're the biggest hypocrites around. I mean, they used that money on one hand, and then on the other hand, you know, they were slamming the president for a stimulus package. So,
Darcy, you had mentioned that President Obama inherited a big mess, but obviously a lot of that mess was created by Wall Street, and the president has bailed out Wall Street probably more than three times the amount of that stimulus. Do you think President Obama could have had the resources, if he had requested the resources, financial resources from Congress, to implement a plan that could have helped toward an economic recovery for working people? Do you think that was within a possibility?
There was
even
a
though
lot
he did
of...
inherit a mess, but what he has done is he has bailed out Wall Street. Could he had also bailed out the working people?
Right. A great question. With the $800 billion TARP bailout, it is separate from the stimulus. But I think the stimulus, I think it could have been larger, and Congress probably would have given it to him. There was a lot of goodwill when he first took office. And remember, the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate then, both houses of Congress. And I think he could have got a much larger stimulus package through. Even a Republican like John Huntsman at the time said that it was too small, you know. So I don't know if he was trying to appease the GOP at that point, like, look how fiscally responsible I am. But the country was hurting. I mean, we had the unemployment rate here in Florida was like 12.3% at the time. He definitely could have, you know, pushed for a much larger stimulus that involved real infrastructure spending, but he neglected to do that, and which is why 4 years later we're still, you know, in the depths of this. And it's not a recession; it is a depression. It's a global depression.
It is a depression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you look at the American voters and people that are going to be going to the polls on November the 6th of this year, do you think many Americans are ready to give President Obama, in your opinion, President Obama a second chance? Just looking at the political landscape.
I think heading into the November election, Obama, I think, has the edge. He'll be the first person since FDR in 36 to be reelected with an unemployment rate, official unemployment rate of, you know, greater than 8%. Of course, our true unemployment rate, if you look at the U6 figures, is much higher than that. We have over 23 million unemployed and probably close to 30 million who are unemployed or underemployed.
But I think
he'll survive mostly because the Republicans have just they don't have a message that appeals to anyone in the middle. I mean, they really are the representing the 1% here, and I think a majority of Americans are, you know, see that. Obama, if he wins, he's almost going to win by default. Hey, he's not quite as bad as the other guy, you know. So that's where we are, and it's really sad because I think 4 years from now we're going to be in the same, or if not worse, economic situation.
There are no bold ideas
coming out of the Obama camp.
Right. Where do you see independents standing in 2006, November 6th election? Where do you see independents? Obama received a lot of support from the independent voters in 2008. Where do you see that vote going? Obviously, most independents are not going to be going to the Republican side or Mitt Romney. Do you think a lot of those independents will look for third-party candidates or just go back and give Obama a second chance?
The most recent polls show that Romney's running ahead of Obama among independents, which is kind of scary. Obama did get a large percentage of the so-called independent vote. But you have to keep in mind, with independent voters, those who've never aligned with either major party or enrolled in a minor party, a lot of them they don't take their politics quite as seriously as people who are committed to an ideology or a party, and a lot of times they're less informed than the average voter. I'm not saying all independents. There definitely are exceptions where they're very, very well informed. But I think overall, the majority of independents, they jump from one party back to the other, depending on the election cycle. But I think if the election were held today, Romney would probably carry the quote independent vote.
I see.
But a lot of independents aren't sophisticated enough to really examine what other options they have. What other parties are running, and then you have that block of 4 or 5% that make up their mind in the final week of the campaign. They start paying attention, and that's kind of scary because
it is.
You know, with all these serious issues, our elections hinge on people that, you know, treat it like watching a show or something. You know, they just don't pay enough attention to make an informed and rational decision.
Well, again, I'd just like to welcome to our program. We have Darcy Richardson with us today. Darcy is a longtime friend of mine, and also he has worked in the campaigns for the Socialist Party USA in 2007 and 2008, and recently ran as a presidential candidate in 2012. And as I mentioned earlier, he's a historian, writer, journalist, and political consultant. Darcy, I always like to take a break. Could you take maybe around 30 seconds or a minute just to reintroduce yourself to our guests? Thank you.
Okay. My name is Darcy Richardson. I'm a native of Jacksonville, Florida. As I mentioned earlier, I've written a number of books on independent third-party politics in the U.S. I'm currently working on a total seven-volume series, five of which are completed. And I have spent a good part of the last 36 years involved in American politics, usually with an independent or third-party campaigns. And I've also done a little bit of journalism, writing for various publications. And I'm just kind of trying to decide what, where we're going to go as a country here after 2012.
Well, we appreciate you coming and joining us on the program once again, Darcy.
My pleasure, Darcy.
Your presidential campaign, well, when you're running as a candidate, was focused on several key areas, and I would just like to touch on a few of those areas. First, you cited Obama's extension of the Bush tax cuts. What were your thoughts on the Bush tax cuts?
I wanted them eliminated. The Bush tax cuts for the, which did, for the middle-income Americans and working-class Americans, I wanted those extended. I was against the tax cuts for the wealthy.
I guess my question is Obama extended those and supported that.
Right.
What were your ideas in regards to him extending the Bush tax cuts? Do you think that was a letdown of a failure of making good on his promises to the American voters?
Yeah, that was a failure of gargantuan proportions. I mean, at a time when we were running such large, deficits, the wealthy really should have been contributing far more than they were. So that was a huge disappointment, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. You also cited concerns about Obama's health care program, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or most people know that as Obamacare. What are your concerns about that?
Basically, I had supported, like a Medicare for All program. The Obama health care plan, while there are, some improvements over what we currently have, it's overall, I think, kind of a gift to the insurance industry. Wasn't at all pleased that he had abandoned the public option, which he had campaigned for. I mean, he was talking about the public option in almost every speech in the autumn campaign of 2008, and he just retreated on that in a heartbeat. So,
well, what difference would that have made if he had have included, if the President Obama had included the public option? Would that made Obamacare more
palatable,
acceptable?
Definitely. Yes.
Pardon me? Okay.
Yeah, much, much more palatable, I think, if he had included that.
Okay. What is your opinion about single payer?
Single payer, I would support single payer as well. We just weren't given any of those options,
Right. And, of course, this was something that was left out of the discussion in Washington because there was talk about putting that on the table. And, obviously, the big insurance industry, they made certain that stayed off the table.
Right.
So, and I know in the past you've been supportive of single payer, even within the Socialist Party USA and other left groups. They have been very supportive of that. You were also concerned about Obama's failure to renew the Glass-Steagall Act. Please share your concerns about that. And also just share a little bit so people can understand what the history of the Glass-Steagall Act is and how it led to what happened in the 90s, how it led to the financial crisis in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed by Congress and signed by FDR in 1933. And what it did is it separated commercial banking from investment or speculative banking, what I call, casino capitalism, which includes all of those derivatives, credit default obligations and credit default swaps, or I should say collateral debt obligations and credit default swaps. So you have all these exotic financial tools now that are pretty much, not regulated. There's no separation between those and traditional, checking accounts and banking, bank accounts, savings accounts. And when that wall was removed, it really put all of these firms in jeopardy, the so-called too big to fail. So we definitely need to restore that. And, there is a movement, Marcy Kaptur from Ohio. She has In April of 2011, she sponsored a bill to reinstate Glass-Steagall. She has, as of, I think, last week or the week before, she has about 79 co-sponsors, including, surprisingly, a couple of Republicans, including Walter Jones of North Carolina. So that's making some headway. But Obama has not embraced it. Timothy Geithner has not embraced it. But I think that's fundamental if we're going to avoid the kind of, you know, financial meltdown that we experienced in September of 2008. That's like a first.
Well, why do you think they haven't embraced that?
Because they're in the,
I mean,
you know,
in
Obama's
hindsight,
the puppet of Wall Street, and
okay.
You know, the Democrats or the president, I should say, has been listening to you know, Geithner and his advisors, and I don't think he really understands the importance of something like Glass-Steagall. And you know, your listeners, Stuart, should be aware that there's actually a very robust Glass-Steagall movement in Europe right now. The rest of the world, I mean, a number of European leaders are embracing it. They think it's fundamental if they're going to ever pull out of their, debt crisis and the problems they're having financially. A number of, like Senator Oscar Petterlini in Italy, he's a state senator. He's sponsored a Glass-Steagall Act in Italy. You have a movement in France by Jacques Chaminade and some others. In fact, in the recent French presidential election, just about every candidate in that race, with the exception of Nicolas Sarkozy, endorsed the Glass-Steagall concept. So people around the world realize it. You know, its importance, and
I wasn't
the president
aware of that.
Has ignored those calls.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the movement seemed like is very strong in Europe, and the politicians here in the U.S., they're only concerned about protecting Wall Street as usual.
Right,
What were your positions also on the when you were running as a candidate for the environment, Darcy?
I ran to protect the environment. I'm definitely concerned with, you know, global warming and,
right.
I didn't talk a lot about the environment, but it wasn't for, you know, lack of interest. It was just, you know, trying to get the basic economic messages, you know, message out. I think, you know, our first priority should be, you know, getting Americans back to work. And, but definitely, you know,
and of course, I know you have a very strong position on the environment. You always have. Now, if one of the things that I've seen that you were very concerned with in your platform, and if you can share with our listeners today, was in regards to cap and trade legislation. What are your concerns about the position of the Obama administration when it comes to cap and trade? And just explain to our listeners a little bit about what cap and trade, what is it all about, please.
Right. Well, I mentioned cap and trade at the outset of my campaign because it was yet another example of where President Obama failed to push something that he had talked about in his campaign in 2008. You know, even when he had a majority in both the House and Senate after taking office, he did little really to push it. But the general idea of cap and trade is, try to achieve a steady reduction in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. And Obama, I mean, that was one of his key issues in 2008. Even John McCain endorsed the idea. But essentially the original draft of the there was a bill in the House, cap-and-trade bill, that was sponsored by Waxman and Markey from Massachusetts. And it was, I think it was called the Climate and Clean Energy Bill. But it was a market-driven system, but it set a ceiling on global warming pollution. And the initial bill wasn't too bad. But what Obama eventually supported was a really, really watered-down version of that. And he did have a majority of the Democrats in the House that favored this watered-down version, but a number of people, like Congressman Kucinich of Ohio, they believed that it was, you know, so weak, and it really was. It was so weak that it might have actually made the problem of global warming even worse than it was if they had enacted it. And but you know, overall, I support strong climate change legislation, you know, if we're ever going to avoid a global catastrophe. And that includes, you know, imposing bans on new coal-fired power plants and new nuclear power plants, and also eliminating all mountaintop coal removal. But Obama dropped all of this as soon as he didn't get his bill through the House. I mean, he hasn't even put that legislation in any budget. I mean, he just totally forgot about it. Just kind of like, okay, well, you know, it didn't get through the House in 2009, and he just more or less walked away from it. But that's you know, a recurring theme here. I mean, he's one thing as a campaigner, and he's certainly different as a chief executive. I mean, he does talk a good game. I mean, millions of people believed in him, and but when push comes to shove, you know, he doesn't really roll up his sleeves and fight. He's trying to present himself, you know, after his Kansas speech in 2011, as more of a, you know, populist, a fighter for the people. But this is all a campaign. You know, he's not. This isn't how he's governed.
You know, I just want to go back on something else that we were spoken about earlier. We were talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA. Do you think, what is your position in regards to President Obama when he went into the White House? You know, my opinion is he should have sought to repeal the Patriot Act. What is your opinion on that?
Oh, I agree 100% with you. Yeah. Repeal the Patriot Act, but of course, you know, and that was something that he talked about, at least repealing parts of it, you know, when he was running, you know, 4 and 5 years ago. But
well, I think all of it should have been repealed. What is your opinion?
All of it. Yes, absolutely.
Right. Because a lot of people don't understand the ramifications of the Patriot Act, like they don't understand the ramifications of the National Defense Authorization Act. What it has done is it has stripped us of our rights and freedoms.
Right.
But what the president has done is he has basically followed in the same path of the Bush administration, and where Bush went out of left office, he just took over from right at that point.
Right. And so, my slogan in my campaign, Stuart, was no fourth term for Bush.
No third term for Bush.
Well, actually,
right.
Fourth. Because his current term would be Bush's third term, right?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Fourth term for Bush, right?
I just want to reintroduce you again. Today we have Darcy Richardson. He's a friend of a long-term friend of mine, and also he's a political consultant. He's for years he has worked with the Socialist Party USA. He has also run as a presidential candidate. Darcy, I just like to do another 30-second, one-minute reintroduction of yourself. Could you please share a little bit about yourself with our listeners?
Okay, thank you, Stuart. Yes, I'm a resident of Jacksonville, Florida, a longtime third-party an independent activist, writer, historian. I've written a number of books, as I mentioned earlier, on independent and third-party politics. And I'm also working on a couple other books right now, including one on the financial crisis, which is called Collapse, How the Managerial Class, you know, led us into the Greatest Depression. Because I think we're actually headed toward disaster. Probably sometime in the spring of 2013, we'll really start seeing it. But that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Right, and a lot of people are a lot of the people in the political arena and many of the experts that look at the economy, they see something on the horizon, which you just mentioned, Darcy, that we are headed for financial crisis and disaster, not only in this country, but on a global level. So,
global, definitely.
You have cited, Darcy, that the Obama administration has has not defended Social Security or Medicare. Explain where the president has fallen short on these two areas. These are two critical areas that will impact millions and millions of Americans, especially our seniors. But where has the president fallen short there?
Well, where he's fallen short is actually in his language. You know, as I mentioned earlier, with the recent debt limit crisis, he expressed a willingness to put both Medicare and Social Security on the chopping block, which should be worrisome for Americans because with the so-called fiscal cliff, and that is a Republican term, with the fiscal cliff that we're facing in January of 2013, one of the main pieces of that are entitlements. And, you know, how will the president respond since he's already expressed a willingness to put both of those programs on the chopping block to get a grand bargain through the House and the Senate? Will he actually agree to massive cuts to entitlements? Is President Obama going to be, you know, an austerity president in his second term? I believe that's a possibility, a real possibility. So we don't just have to fear the Republicans, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan and some of their advisors from the Chicago School or the Austrian School of Economics. We also have to worry about our Democratic president because we don't know what he's going to do to help, fashion some sort of grand bargain if he does win on November 6th. So that should be very worrisome to everybody. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, what I see, Darcy, whether it's a Democratic president from the Democrats or the Republicans, I see either individual ushering in austerity measures come 2013. It doesn't matter which party, and as I mentioned quite often, it's one party with two names. But
right.
I see austerity already on the way within the next six to 9 months within this country. Now, I don't think the majority of Americans are ready for what is coming down the pipeline.
Right, right. Yeah, very good point. I was going to say, you know, I was a little bothered by Mitt Romney. Well, I'm bothered by him entirely to begin with, but with his choice of a running mate, you know, Paul Ryan and, you know, his devotion to Ayn Rand, it should raise some eyebrows. I mean, if we are looking at a possible austerity future, you know, the Austrians, by that I mean the Austrian economists, like Friedrich Hayek during the Great Depression, he advised governments not to do anything, just let the depression play itself out. Well, you know, millions of people were on the verge of starvation had his policies prevailed, and.
Right.
But this is, you know, Paul Ryan, this is one of the people that has had a great influence on him. So that should be very worrisome, I think, to everybody.
One of the things I've seen what you've said, Darcy, you have stated that we need a president who understands what it will take to end this depression, somebody with extensive private sector experience. I know you say the nation is in a depression. Where do you see that leadership, or where do you see someone that has that experience that could lead us out of this depression?
Unfortunately, I don't.
Because
you know,
we are
in a depression. I'm sorry?
I agree with what you said earlier. We are in a depression.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most people can't – they hear recession, and we're almost to the point where recession, double dipping like that, well, that's not too bad.
Right. We're definitely in a global depression. It's pretty bad when members of the European Parliament, including like someone like Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party, he's predicting in just a matter of months we're going to have an entire banking collapse in Europe. It's going to be like dominoes. And, you know, if that happens, we have to keep in mind that with the recent Fed audit, the Fed has provided, and Buddy Romer got this, and he was really good on this issue. About a quarter of the $29.6 trillion that was infused into the banking or the financial markets, from 2007 through 2011, about a quarter of that went directly to European banks. So we have
a
huge stake in this. And if the banks in Europe start falling one after another, these are Deutsche Bank and Barclays. These are all too big to fail. But if they start collapsing, ours are going to collapse. And that's going to lead to something the world has never experienced.
We'll have utter chaos. If we're talking about a global financial collapse,
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about what's taking place here in this country,
mm-hmm.
I know you're not the analyst that can make a statement on how we can avert this, but mm-hmm. what are the first steps, in your opinion?
Well, I think governments have to be propped up in Europe. Countries like Greece, which was given a bailout, we can't allow for countries to start falling one after another, and then
mm-hmm.
of course they're indebted to the banks. The banks are going to collapse, and unfortunately, I think probably the only way to avoid that is by continuing to pump money into the European economy, into the U.S. economy, but I wouldn't do it through the banks. What I would do,
mm-hmm.
or what I would, and like Webster Griffin Tarpley has suggested this and some others, but nationalize the Federal Reserve, the whole banking cartel, put it under the taxpayers, and we can start printing the money necessary to avoid a total collapse.
Well, one of the things, what you're saying, you say pump money back into the bank, into the economies,
right, into the
countries. Because when you pump money into the countries, like what has happened here in the U.S., you pump money into the economy, and it makes
mm-hmm.
the richest people even richer.
Right.
As socialists, we believe that if those monies go into the economy, it should
right.
go for the benefit of working people, not just for the wealthy. How do you
right.
make certain that it gets to the working people and provide jobs and make certain that students aren't strapped with student loan debts? How do you make certain that that money, once it goes into the economy, that is distributed properly where everyone is able to benefit in society?
Well, here's how...
because I say socialism is a solution for that. What is
mm-hmm.
your opinion on that?
I agree. By nationalizing the Federal Reserve, and what you could do is what Dr. Kavari and I talked about in 2010, establish
mm-hmm.
Establish state banks, state-owned banks, kind of like the State Bank of North Dakota, which was founded by the Nonpartisan League, which was a socialist-oriented organization back in the early 1900s. And they will act as the credit facilitator. And they would loan that money out at next to, at very, very low interest rates. In some cases, maybe no interest rate. So you would have control over it so that you would know it would be going to the farmers, the workers, small businesses. I would include small businesses definitely in that because small businesses in this so-called recovery have had a very, very difficult time getting credit.
Mm-hmm.
But also students and everyone else. So it's basically we would have to take over the banking system,
just completely take it over.
Right. And let the too big to fail, let them fail.
Let them fail.
The problem
student loan debt.
Student loan debt.
Right now it's well over $1 trillion. How would
right,
you deal with
right.
that?
I think
that
we need
be
to forgive
forgiven?
A large portion of that.
Okay.
Forgive a large portion of that, if not everything.
And of course, myself, I believe we need to forgive all of it.
Right.
Because, as myself as a socialist candidate for president, I believe
mm-hmm.
that, education should be free.
Right.
Students shouldn't start on the road of a career strapped with, tens of thousands of dollars in debt. So,
right. I could support that.
We just recently had two conventions And I have seen people right here in Southern California talking about, they haven't been talking about the politics and what's going on and how people are out of work, but they talk about the great speeches that were there in the conventions. What was your assessment of the convention for the Democrats, and also you right there in Florida, the convention for the Republicans? What was your opinion?
Well, I couldn't really stand to watch the Republican convention. I couldn't stomach it. But I did watch some of the speeches at the Democratic convention, and there were some pretty good speeches. Bill Clinton, moved everybody, but he neglected to mention that, by repealing Glass-Steagall, he led to much of the nation's economic problems. But Obama, the Obama administration, again spoke a good game. I think they kind of rallied their base somewhat. They've been very disillusioned, and he's. They probably did an effective enough job that he can survive, this campaign against Romney. It's going to be very close. The Democratic speeches were better, but they didn't really say, there was nothing really introduced in that convention that was bold and imaginative enough to pull the country out of this this malaise. I mean, it's I'm kind of resigned to. We haven't even begun to see the worst of this yet. So
both campaigns, in my opinion, have really stayed away from the big issues: how they're going to put millions of people back to work, how they're going to end the war, how they're going to stop, how they're going to be able to resolve the matter of the student loan debt. That, as I mentioned, millions of students are being strapped with. But I didn't hear that in either convention. It was basically both campaigns are very sidetracked just to be able to put on a showcase for people watching and also to obtain votes. That's what I saw.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There were a couple of performances. There were like two really long commercials. Not a lot of substance there.
One of the things I wanted to get into, just back to, you had mentioned someone with extensive private sector experience. Obviously, Mitt Romney, he has extensive private sector experience, and of course you know that I don't support him in the least bit.
Right.
However, there are millions of Republicans who would rather chance another 4 years with Obama. When you look at, that political horizon and leaders, let's just take a quick glance at Mitt Romney. If by chance he was elected president, which, hopefully that doesn't happen in the next 20 years, but if he was elected, do you think with his private sector experience that he could do better than Barack Obama?
No. In fact, when I made that comment, that was when I just publicly came out, I believe, for, Buddy Romer. And I was really kind of referring to his, experience in business. He's not really a career politician. I mean, he did serve, four terms in Congress, but and one term as governor of Louisiana. But spent most of his life in the private sector as a banker who's never foreclosed on a single homeowner or farmer. He has some real life private sector experience. I think he would have been. Much more preferable to either President Obama or Mitt Romney. Romney's just an asset stripper, a pump and dump, takeover financier, and he's not going to bring anything to the White House that is going to make the situation better. If anything, it's going to make.
Well, I think he's going to bring something to the White House that's going to really improve the situation for Wall Street, and that's it. He's not going to do anything for working people.
Not at all.
One last question I have, and then I'm going to have you to give whatever websites and just a couple of announcements for myself. In 2007, that's when I met you, and you were working with the Brian Moore Alexander campaign with the Socialist Party USA. What made you decide to work with the Socialist Party USA and help with their 2008 bid and for the Brian Moore campaign?
Okay, that's a good question. Let me just preface it with, you know, one
and
of
I
my
might
heroes,
mention, Socialist Party USA is a Socialist
is,
Party.
Norman Thomas, you know, who of course ran for president
right.
six times between 1928 and 1948. So I've always had an affinity for the Socialist Party, agree with almost everything in the party's platform and always have. And, you know, I had, over the years, I had admired people like, you know, David McReynolds and met Walt Brown when he was running. As I mentioned earlier, you know, hosted him here in Florida for a week, the final week of the campaign, in fact. Brian Moore was an old friend. I had managed his anti-war candidacy for the U.S. Senate in 2006. So when he sought the, you know, the Socialist Party nomination, I think it was in St. Louis in 2007. You know,
in St. Louis, 2007.
You know, I tried to help him, you know, to, you know, whatever degree I could. And you know, Brian, it was a difficult campaign because Brian was new to socialism and very new to the party. He had just joined the party, I think, in August and then was nominated in October. So
right, 2 months
for him,
before
it was
the
a
nomination.
Learning curve. But I think he did the best he could. He tried to, you know, study the party and study the party's history and get an understanding of, you know, what issues were important to the SPUSA. But of course, you know, that like any third party campaign, that had, you know, it had its rough moments, as you're well aware, and including, you know, the presidential candidate didn't want to speak to the vice presidential candidate, and
But I do appreciate all the support that you have actually given to the socialist movement, and also to make certain that. That we stay out there and relevant to millions of Americans. Darcy, what I'd like you to do is just take a few seconds just to how people can contact you, any websites that you have. And again, I'd like to extend my appreciation for you coming on the program today. Could you just give whatever websites where people can reach you?
Yes. I do blog at a website called uncoveredpolitics.com. I try to put up articles there every week. And my email address is listed on that that website. I don't know. Do you want me to give out my email address, or is that?
No, just that's all. If they just go,
yeah, they go
on
to uncovered
a search and just look for Uncovered
Politics,
they should be able to find you, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Right. So as I mentioned, we have Darcy Richardson. He will be back with us next week. Darcy will be next week. We'll be getting a little bit more into the various models for capitalism, how it has worked in this country or how it has not worked in this country, and also we're going to be discussing a little bit about international politics, talking about things such as the war, the global economy, and as I mentioned, Darcy, he'll be with us next week. That'll be on the 17th. Just so people can reach me, you can reach the Stuart Alexander, Alex Mendoza campaign. That's at Stuart Alexander. That's STEWARTALEXANDER, for president, 2012.org. Once again, that's Stuart Alexander, for president, 2012.org. And once again, Darcy, I look forward to seeing you next week. Again, thanks to our listeners for joining us. And have a good day and a good week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Stuart. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.